to resonate through the room with this gadget that Hans just attached to me. The book that I've been asked to discuss is an autobiographical work called Encounters, and it comes with the additional feature beside my beautiful, carefully crafted prose of pictures of my parents, wife, children, and above all, my basset hound. And I urge you to buy this book if for no other reason than to contemplate the beauty of the animal in the pictorial part of the work. But that's not why I've been asked to speak today. I've been asked to provide you with, I suppose, what would be called the political teachings of my work. I ran across that absolutely ghastly term, political teachings, while doing research for a book that I'm now laboring over on Leo Strauss's disciples and their political influence. And anything they like is a political teaching. Anything they don't like is dangerous to democracy and fascist or something like that. But my book has good political teachings, so I'm very happy to stand up here and present them to you today. There, in addition to the anecdotal parts of the work, the biographies of famous people, which was part of the obligatory assignment that the publisher imposed on me when I signed a contract, there are two, should we say, sort of crucial political teachings, to use the term again, or political doctrines, which come through to anyone who reads this book with some care. One of them is a very detailed and often sarcastic discussion of the various lefts. The other, which I'll get around to afterwards, is an attempt to distinguish right and left. And I've always been interested in the problems of political terminology and political epistemology, and you know exactly what distinguishes one political position from another, and also with the mutations of right, left, in the Western world in the last 150 years. As I indicate in the book, perhaps somewhat disingenuously, it is not entirely true, I became interested in the neoconservatives because they seem to be an interesting case of what is essentially a leftist group that has been able to present themselves effectively as conservative opposition. But what I do is sort of look at the left at the time that I was a graduate student, and I think you can see in Nietzsche sort of in sort of outline form what becomes characteristically leftist afterwards. If you read my chapter on Herbert Marcuse, it is more than simply a celebration of a fellow German Jew who was part of a very humanistic, humanistically educated generation who landed up in the United States, who was in some ways very conservative, culturally conservative, despite all the goofy things that he wrote, and who was very nice to me personally. It also is an attempt to understand him as a kind of transitional figure between an older left, real left, I mean a kind of Stalinist, communist, you know, left, the as it exists at least in the Western world, you know, in the Parti Communiste de France or the Partito Comunista in Italy, the two largest Western communist parties. Somebody who always, you know, has a warm spot for Stalin, is always willing to justify his crimes on the basis of the principle that it takes, you have to break eggs to make an omelet or something like that, but at the same time had an intellectual philosophical orientation that seemed to come out of the old world at an earlier period, out of the 19th, even 18th century. And in some ways, he seems to be almost emblematic for this left that I encountered as a young man. And I cannot say that I was terribly fond of their politics. And I said I was absolutely nauseated by Marcuse's willingness to defend Stalin's crimes. On the other hand, I was impressed by what I saw of a traditional humanistic kind of learning that was mixed with this obviously repulsive political stance. But by the end of his life, as you know, particularly after he failed to obtain a post-retirement graduate position at Yale, where I studied with him, he went off to California and became totally bonkers. He just went off the deep end helped position his last few years to fashion the new left in its ugliest forms in the United States. I remember at the time that he died, National Review wrote some very nasty obituary, almost as nasty as the one that Bill Buckley later penned about poor Murray Rothbard. I immediately put pen to paper and wrote a defense of him, which National Review, of course, never published, because he was you know, viewed as a bad person because of his pro-communist positions. But, of course, I had a very different memory of him. I write about three different types of leftists that I encountered while sitting in the Yale Sterling Library in the Graduate Hall. One kind of leftist, and this was sort of what pretended the future of the left, were very whiny New York Jews, and they saw anti-Semitism in every, you know, gentlemanly wasp who was walking there. He really hates us, and so forth. My own impression, as I also indicate in the book, is that the old wasp patrician class was totally disintegrating at this time. They had been perhaps overly gracious to the newcomers by letting them come in and take over while they, you know, continued to commit suicide as a hegemonic or ruling class in the United States. Their influence had actually declined enormously in post-World War II period, and much of it was a kind of self-eclipsing that they engage in this period. And the whiny New York Jews were always complaining, everyone's an anti-Semite, this one's a fascist, this. And when it came to the war between Israel and the Arabs, they all became extreme Zionist nationalists. And so then you had the Catholics, who also in America sort of view themselves as a minority, and they would generally follow the lead of the Jewish intellectuals. But when the war broke out between the Israelis and the Arabs, their position was, we have to go to church and pray, or, you know, we have to be Thomas Aquinas, or do something like that, or we have to have a prayer vigil. So they were sort of like more consistent. And then I finally describe what I met of remnants of the old WASP patrician in my book, and these people would play golf, try to get some position in their family business, yet they seemed to elicit violent hatred, especially from the Jewish Marxists, who were, you know, saw them as rivals or people who had excluded them from positions. I disliked them myself, or I despised them, because they seemed to be a ruling class that had lost any nerve and any sense of command. And my favorite of all political sociologists is Pareto, who understood that classes fall from power because they lose their nerve, which is also what my friend Sam Francis taught. And other classes rise because they take advantage of disintegration. And, you know, I feel in some ways sorry for the old WASP patricians. On the other hand, I feel utter contempt for them, for the way they abandoned power and engaged in spasms of self-mortification afterwards. Self-hate, politics of guilt, etc. So this is sort of my descriptions of the left. And if you read the work, you know, and then it comes to the neoconservatives, and I see this as a more moderate kind of left, and a post, what I call post-Marxist left. I wrote a book on this, trying to show how the post-Marxist left is different from the Marxist left, because they're not really socioeconomic in their orientation. They're cultural. They're heavily influenced by Adorno and the Frankfurt School, which is an accusation that is sometimes made against them by religious fundamentalists and John Birchers in the United States. It's perfectly correct. It's perfectly correct. You read The Authoritarian Personality, you have the whole scenario you know, of what the left intends to do. This is a bit of a cultural left. They hate the bourgeoisie, but not because they see them as economic oppressors. They see them as fascist, sexist, religious men. People who have to be entirely retrained, if necessary, you know, sent to some internment camp or something like this. And this is the left that will end up taking over in the end, and particularly after the disintegration of the Soviet Empire. And the two, but I would argue that in the West, this left takes over earlier because this left are basically the kooks who are part of the communist parties, but whom the communists sort of discipline and control. And they're also the nutcases in Eastern Europe whom the communists or the Stalinists are able to control. These are the leftists who will take power, the anti-fascist left, heavily influenced by a kind of Frankfurt School agenda. And what I suggest in my book is they take over the entire Western world. I mean, the extent of their rule and their cultural hegemony cannot be undone. I mean, they have power over the media. They have power over the state apparatus, public administration. And opposing them is like knocking your head against the wall. And I gave these lectures in Romania. And these seem to be sort of a relatively untouched people because they had the good or bad fortune of living under Soviet rule for a while. Ceausescu, I know, was a horrible man. But at least they were spared Western cultural Marxist influences for a few decades longer than the Germans, who seem to be the worst basket, psychological basket cases in the world. But the same thing, of course, is happening in France, in England, Spain, certainly in Spain. And in the United States. And I think many of the impulses leading to this cultural, this new form of cultural hegemony come out of the United States. I mean, one of the things I try to show in my book on cultural Marxism, and the post-Marxist left, and I suggest this here as well, is that the United States is a breeding ground for many of these ideas. The authoritarian personality was not considered the work of quirky leftist in the United States. It had mainstream respectability. And people like Seymour Morton Lipset wrote in defense of this because this was to be what we as American patriots could do to overcome prejudice and build a pluralistic society. So let's say the model for this comes out of American globalism. Globalism and bureaucracy, you know, the sort of a fatal combination which you now see in the European Union, which is not really about Europe, but it's about global bureaucracy and the re-socialization of nations. So if you read my book carefully, it is obvious that I'm, you know, heavily influenced, or the book shows the influences of other works, and if there are any kind of political teachings there, it's an attempt to show how the left, as we now know it, came to be formed during my youth. I can see these different groups, and the Marxist and the traditional Marxist losing influence to this. And I just wanted this one conversation between Eugene Genovese, who went from being a very unusual idiosyncratic Marxist to becoming very conservative and very Catholic, is having a conversation with Eric Hobsbawm, I don't know if he's still alive. If he is, he is still a member of the English Communist Party and will defend Stalin. Did to his dying day. If he's alive, it's about 98. But Hobsbawm and Genovese are lamenting the fact that the communists, we used to have good communists, now there's these crazy people who run around with this exotica, you know, glorifying exotic things and crazy lifestyles. You know, what is the left coming to? And I was at present in that conversation back in 1970, because I was young, I was giving a presentation at the American Historical Association, a panel with Genovese, and Hobsbawm came over and congratulated me for my remarks, in which I showed the difference between true Marxist-Leninism and this sort of new leftist sentimentality, which eventually morphs into this cultural Marxist monstrosity in the West. And all the traditional communists liked what I had to say. And I've always told people I have a warm spot for communists after seeing the absolute disastrous types who have taken their place in the West. It's like, you know, you go from the frying pan into the fire. The second I might say, political teaching here, which is sort of interesting. And also, I was interested in Richard Spencer's remarks because I sort of recognized in some of them, not as remarks on race consciousness, but in some of the other ones, the effects of my book on the conservative movement, in which I show to what extent the conservative movement gives up on classes, nations, you know, and becomes preoccupied with values. And it lands, of course, the values change. It's a new value every week. It depends on the election. And increasingly, their values are leftist values. So the argument they then make is that they believe in values, and the left has no values. We have values, you don't. But leftist values, too. They're leftist values, and you have leftist values. You know, what's the difference? Except you have different. Your leftist values are 20 years older. They have newer leftist values. I mean, this is the only difference that I can see. But that's what happens when a movement, I think, really becomes disengaged from the bourgeoisie or from traditional nations or nations or something like that. So basically, the right and the left are both peddling globalist ideologies. The right's globalist ideology is human rights, democracy, and bombing other countries to make sure they get the message from us. The left's ideology is reconstructing people's consciousness at home. So this seems to be like the major difference. But they both are operating with leftist values. It seems to me that the right, insofar as it is distinguishable from the left, and this sounds very basic, it's sort of like the kind of basic definition that one of my intellectual, if not always political heroes, Carl Schmitt, whom I did a book, comes up with. And Schmitt, of course, gives you the l'essence du politique, or the begriff des politischen. And this really comes down, which is the same, by the way, that Gianfranco Emilio, who was quoted before, comes up. But the essence of the political is friend-enemy distinction. Well, I would say that the essence of the left is equality, egalitarianism. That is what holds everything on the left together. Now, the essence of the right is not necessarily liberty, it's inequality. I think I presented this last year. People were aghast when I said this, but I'll say it again. Libertarians, to the extent that they're on the right, such as Herrnsheim and Hoppe, would believe that inequality is fine. This is the natural state of people. Left libertarians tend to be egalitarians, and I would make that distinction. They want equality. They like civil rights movements. Quality of lifestyles, everybody should be able to cross borders, everybody's interchangeable with everybody else, and everyone, you know, has human rights or something. Okay, so I would say that even among libertarians, there's a very definite, there's a critical distinction that I see. And this is how in my book on the conservative movement, I could say that, you know, even some fascists and some libertarians can belong on the right because they're opposing egalitarian projects. And they believe that human beings are inherently unequal. Okay. Now, I'm not saying this to praise everybody on the right. I'm just saying this is what distinguishes right from left. The problem now is that what is the legitimate political spectrum and those political parties that are not being denounced as fascist, racist, anti-Semitic, or something like that, or anti-feminist, are all committed to equality. And they're all committed to using the state to achieve equality. Okay, so the only parties I see in the United States are leftist parties. By the way, I know that this may be an expression of either naivete or senility in my case, but I was struck by the fact that the neoconservatives and the Republican Party went after Rand Paul for simply questioning Provision 2 and 7, I think, of the Civil Rights Act, saying that it gave the government too much power to interfere in private social relations in this. I think, if anything, that is a glaring understatement in terms of the effects. This is something which has been used to sue the pants off people because they don't serve blacks or some other group or women coffee, fat, it's not warm enough or whatever. The Civil Rights Act has been the beginning of all kinds of government mischief and social engineering against the private sector. But once he had said this, and of course he cried, he goes back, and he expresses his regret he couldn't be on freedom rides with Martin Luther King, and he had this. But somehow, once he had opened Pandora's box, the entire respectable Republican, which of course means neoconservative, establishment violently attacked him. Now, I cannot understand how you can get government off your back, if this is what they say. They're good. I hear Jonah Goldberg, who attacked him as the ally of bigots, and you know this, or he always is yapping about economic freedom, this guy. How do you have economic, how do you have freedom unless you can push the government out of these relations? At the minimum. And of course, I know the people using it have no desire for any freedom. They just want to bomb Iran. I mean, I fully understand what this is. And they're not even going to get rid of Obama's medical plan. They're just going to redistribute, do something a little bit different. I understand why the Republicans are useless, basically leftist and also bellicose opposition to the Democrats. But you would think that a remark like that would be allowable. You know, if Jonah Goldberg can accuse FDR of being like Hitler and they're all Nazis, and he says this, and nobody cares. But as soon as you touch the Civil Rights Act and you notice that it infringes on privacy, that does not allow you to form men's clubs, that all the evils that go on in terms of government, social engineering, diversity classes, all of this goes back to the Civil Rights Act of 1964. You would think at the very least you would be able to question this. But even this is unacceptable. And I think that the reason is that both of our political parties, left and acceptable left and right, which will appear together in every issue of the Washington Post. You have the neocons and the liberals. You open the New York Times, you have David Brooks, Ross Dowdat, whatever, I don't know how you pronounce his name, some silly name, and he writes even sillier columns. But if you read this stuff, it is obvious that there's no significant difference between these people, and they're all equally on the left. And this is something that I became interested in, and one of the things I do in my autobiography is I look at people who are generally considered leftist, but who seem more conservative to me, or more rightist, you know, than so-called conservatives of today. And I look at somebody like Christopher Lash, who has these crazy guild socialist ideas. At first he was a kind of quasi-Marxist. Later he became a Catholic corporatist, although he remained a Presbyterian. But if you're talking about family issues, he had very traditional views on men and women and other things, and was actually appalled by, you know, by the cultural Marxism. He wrote books attacking cultural Marxism. And I show that even in the case of Genovese, when he was a Marxist, you know, and even expressed sympathy for the Viet Cong, he sounded much more like a conservative than any conservative that I hear on Fox News. As you read this work, and as I wrote it, I became aware, you know, of how far my country had drifted in about 30 years. And I think the change in Europe is far greater, I mean, in a country like Germany or France or Spain or England, than anything that we've seen in the United States. Because for a long time, I think the United States, while it spread these poisons, it was also sort of protected against them. Because Americans don't take ideas very seriously. You know, and just the way Romanians have not been exposed to cultural Marxism yet. And, you know, does it work? Is it good for business or something like that? But I noticed that what happened is that American patriotism became defined, even during the Cold War, in terms of whether you support a certain kind of radical social engineering. You know, and this, I think, Richard Spencer mentioned Harry Jaffa. And Jaffa, of course, who becomes one of the major spokesmen of the American conservative movement, believes he's a conservative because he favors universal equality and sees the American state as a vehicle for spreading equality everywhere. And this is conservative, and as he becomes the leading figure at National Review, already in the time of William Buckley in the early 1970s, something that I think Peter Brimlow and I would probably have been unaware of for many years after, you know, after this happened, it was obvious that, you know, these radical leftists, even Trotskyists, Jacobin, they all became part of the conservative agenda. And this was before the neoconservatives took over the conservative movement. And I think this, perhaps I should say this in closing, that it's my discussion of Murray Rothbard shows that although he expressed these very individualistic ideas and so forth, that in some ways he was profoundly conservative in his social cultural views. There's no question that, you know, and I have this sort of touching scene in which he and Russell Kirk, who's sort of this Burkean conservative, come together in the living room of Pat Buchanan. We were all on his, I was on his committee when he ran for president in 1992. These people were there for different reasons. Obviously, Rothbard did not buy his Buchanan's protectionism, neither did I. But he liked him on foreign policy and generally agreed with him on immigration. Kirk was there because his wife nagged him into going or something like that. A very domineering wife who she generally controlled all of his actions. And she told him he was going to serve on this committee. But when the two of them began to speak, it was obvious they agreed on much more than they disagreed about. And Kirk had, this might interest you, Kirk always thought of himself within the American context as a Taft Republican. He was always a Taft Republican. And he's an isolationist. And he sort of got drafted into World War II when he was put in charge of minding some army base out in the deserts of Utah, but he was never really in the war. And I think that's when he first read Albert Nock, when he was in that situation. And as much as he spoke about Burke and European concern, he was a small-town American. In the post-war years, of course, he writes about the conservative rout, which then becomes the conservative victory when he's able to sell the books or finds a publisher who changes the title of his book. It wasn't the victory, conservative mind. You see, it's alive and well in America and so forth. He didn't believe that for a second. But I think his conservatism in the American context was basically sort of anti-New Deal, isolationist, maybe American Republicanism, of the Taft variety. And that was pretty much Rothbard's view. And I remember I was in the room talking with them, and we all agreed. You know, so when it came to the United States, you know, what was best for America politically at that point, I don't think there was much disagreement. This really is the final point. I must take exception with my gracious host on one point. I don't think the John Randolph Club, which both of us were involved, disintegrated over the or fell apart primarily over Pat Buchanan. I think actually people on both sides generally supported him, and Murray Rothbard was an ardent supporter of Pat Buchanan. It fell apart because of a person who remained unmentioned, whom I think did everything he could to seize power within that group, and basically drove the rest of us out. Whether you're on the paleoconservative or paleolibertarian side made no difference. But I have to agree with Hans that it was a group that showed at one time enormous promise. I do mention this in my book. I think one can be critical of the fact that I do not deal as harshly with that event as I might have. I try to be gracious even toward ex-friends, for former friends, in the work. But I think the John Randolph Club at one time was a very promising vehicle for a paleo-libertarian, paleo-conservative alliance. There were obviously differences, but I think these differences became exaggerated because of the person who eventually caused the break to come about, who is not in this room, I should mention. I feel free to speak about this. And I do go into a discussion of the John Randolph Club. It's a bit superficial, but I do suggest that at one time it did offer a significant means for bringing conservative groups together. I also point out, you do very well to pick up this book. It is, I read it over and I am delightfully surprised by the elegance of my own prose. I usually don't write this way. I write sort of in heavy Weberian, you know, terminology, whether I'm writing English or German or anything else. But this book is very, very, it's a pleasure to read, even for me and for my students to whom I assigned it. In any case, thank you for your indulgence.